A year ago today, Boston University student Yael Krinsky headed into surgery after a decade of doctor's appointments and tests. She thought she had found what was causing her constant gastrointestinal pain, or at least she hoped. As she prepared for the operation, she told her doctor that she wanted him to find endometriosis inside her, and he did. Endometriosis affects an estimated 1 in 10 women, according to the World Health Organization. It causes tissue similar to the uterine lining to grow outside the organ, sometimes in other parts of the body, and the tissues become inflamed around the time of menstruation, which causes a wide range of symptoms, including debilitating pain and migraines. There are treatments, but no cure. Now, in a bit, we'll talk to an MIT researcher who is studying the disease. But first, Yael's journey, one in which her father, Alvin, was by her side. We spoke with Yael and Alvin yesterday, and I started by asking Yael how she's feeling 1 year after the surgery.
Up and down, and it has been, I would say, one of the hardest, if not the hardest year of my life. Recovery is not easy. Kind of stomaching that diagnosis is not easy. However, notably, the thing that I suffered from for over a decade has almost 60% resolved since that surgery. I would say that mental health-wise, I feel like a different person when you've gone 10 years feeling like not only everyone else is gaslighting you, but you're starting to gaslight yourself, which is a whole another slew of issues. So just waking up and existing and knowing that it was not all in my head, that I am validated, that I have a surgeon who has it on video, that I have on my computer. There's nothing that can replicate that feeling for me thus far.
You say 60% resolved. For our listeners who are not familiar with endometriosis, what are some of the symptoms that were haunting you, you know, plaguing you, that are better or resolved since your surgery?
I'm going to sort of split that into two, which is that most notably for endometriosis, there is the sort of like very typical, if you Google endometriosis symptoms, you'll get very painful periods. And when I say painful, that can range from not being able to get out of bed, go to work, have conversations, to full-blown, I'm in labor, I need to go to the hospital. It can be nerve pain, very heavy bleeding, migraines, excessive and extreme fatigue. I did not have really any of those telltale signs. I had debilitating gastrointestinal issues. I was having diarrhea every single day for about 10 years. I couldn't keep food down normally. I was not digesting properly. And I would say up until a year ago, I kind of identified as someone with a gastrointestinal disease. And I've made sure before this conversation with you, Tiziana, that I kind of went through all the doctors I'd seen in 13 years. It was 76.
So when you say that you felt gaslighted, it's because 76 doctors, diagnoses, theories about what was wrong, and none of it was what was actually happening to you.
Yes, I would say that it was a combination of that, but also in their bedside manner. Now, not all of them were, I don't want to demonize doctors, and there's many of them that are wonderful. And, you know, several doctors, one of them had called me nutty. I remember I looked through my diary, and that was one day he said, "You're starting to sound a little nutty, Yael." I had a doctor that, because my mother is Moroccan Jewish, my father's Jewish, insinuated that it was my Jewish, you know, ancestral trauma, I think relating to the Holocaust, that it was coming up somatically and that it was not indeed a physical ailment. I had therapists as well who suggested it was psychosomatic, hypochondriac, that I needed to do somatic therapy. It was pretty much all of that. And in the end, what happens is that when a doctor doesn't know, you know, we don't really live in a world where doctors want to say, "I actually don't know. I want to help you, but I don't know." And what they end up saying is, "I don't find anything, so everything's okay." Everything's not okay, obviously. So at some point, I would say 5 years in, I started to truly gaslight myself. I had moments of really, which I'm sure my dad can speak to, but I had very disturbing mental health dips where I started to think I was crazy.
So I would like now, and I appreciate you sharing your experience, I would like now to turn to you, Alvin. As a father, this sounds like watching your kid go through something torturous.
Yeah, it was. It was agonizing. It was terrible. I mean, you know, any father, most fathers would want to do everything they can for their child. And I just felt helpless. And I would ask Yael all the time over these over those 10 years, I wish I was a doctor. I wish I, how can I help? What can I do? And I tried the best I could to help. I ferried her to different doctors, driving hundreds of miles sometimes to different therapists and so forth. But bottom line is, I just was in agony seeing my daughter be in such turmoil.
So a year ago, Yael had surgery, which confirmed diagnosis, was at least partial treatment. How did you get there? 76 doctors, misdiagnose, don't diagnose, and finally, you find the one. How did that happen?
So I moved myself to Portland, Oregon. I had read that there were gastrointestinal doctors that were more renowned, it was alarming to me that it was in Portland, Oregon, but I did decide to move there. Once I got there about a year in, I started to have those initial classic endometriosis symptoms that I told you about at the beginning of this call. Now, I decided to start babysitting for a little bit of money. So I started nannying and I found someone named Zaria. And her husband is Dr. Nicholas Fogelson.
I'm sorry, Dr. Fogelson is the doctor who did the surgery?
Yes. And one day, Dr. Nicholas Fogelson came in the door and he was home early and I got to meet him. And he said, oh, I'm a specialist, I'm a surgeon in endometriosis surgery. And I continued to babysit her and have no idea that I had endometriosis for about a year. And at one point, it was a mixture of me seeing this happen, knowing what he does. And I went to my doctor at the time, and she was the first person who actually said to me, I cannot continue to try and diagnose your gastrointestinal disorder unless I have endometriosis ruled out. So I got that checked. And what happened is I actually called Dr. Fogelson, and he said, you know, I'll come in. I won't charge you. You come in. I'll just check. You know, I know that financial barriers are a thing. It's very expensive. At the time, he had his own clinic. And I had no idea stepping into that home when I started babysitting that I was stepping into a renowned surgeon's home.
So I want to stop you there because I want to turn to you, Alvin, for a minute now. And as a parent, to hear that what gave your daughter relief was this random, after all the time and energy you had put in to actively trying to seek her diagnosis and treatment, what's your reaction to that?
Yeah, that's pretty crazy, isn't it? You know, there's a lot of luck and coincidence in life, but often it is preceded by a lot of hard work. So that's how I think about this. But it shouldn't have to be that way.
So what do you want it to be instead, Alvin?
You know, since her diagnosis, and Yael recommended that I read a couple of books about it, which I did, and discovered that it affects so many women and girls. And it takes an average of there's an average of 8 to 12 years between the onset of symptoms and a correct diagnosis. And that's what happened to my daughter. So what do I think? I think that this condition affecting so many people has gone under the radar because it's about women. And we all know that women are not looked upon and treated the same way as men. That's just the way the world has been. It's getting better. But I think that this condition needs to be brought into the training of physicians much more than it seems to have been up to now.
Alvin, you feel so strongly about this. I think I can actually hear you kind of hitting the table with your hand. You feel very strongly about this.
Yeah, because my daughter went through hell for over 10 years and I couldn't do anything about it.
So, Yael, you're now studying public health at Boston University. What are you studying and what's your goal with the degree?
I'm studying public health, but I will tell you that I'm currently in this phase of my life where I'm also trying to get back to being an artist. I have realized through all this, I don't want to be a practitioner, and I am well suited in largely in advocacy and writing. And
so 10 years from now, if you're successful as an artist and an advocate on this subject, what's different?
What is different, first and foremost, probably, is that school nurses, people in educational institutions, are well informed about endometriosis and trauma, and understanding that there can be a bigger picture than what we look at right away.
That was Yael Krinsky and her father, Alvin Krinsky. So what to do? Professor Linda Griffith is working on it. Griffith directs the Center for Gynopathology Research at MIT. She and her colleagues have been studying endometriosis and other related diseases for more than a decade, and she joins on the line from Denver, where she is attending the annual meeting of the Society for Reproductive Investigation. Professor Griffith, thanks for the time. Welcome to Radio Boston.
It's good to be here.
So let me just start with asking you, I know you were listening to that conversation we just played, your reactions, is it in line with your experience, other experiences you've heard from women with endometriosis?
Oh, it's all too common. And I especially resonated with the terrible gastrointestinal symptoms that she had as a pediatric patient. Pediatric patients, including my niece, including myself, often do present with really terrible GI problems that come to the fore, and the other problems are overlooked, and endometriosis is not suspected, and patients are gaslit exactly as she described. It's terrible, and it still happens every single day to women in this country and around the world.
So there are a bunch of threads in what you just said that I want to pick up on. And the first is, you talked about the gastrointestinal symptoms. One of the things that struck me in reading for today was the wide, wide range of symptoms one might see with endometriosis. And that's got to be overwhelming from the perspective of both experiencing it and being diagnosed.
So it's certainly overwhelming as a patient. And then to go into the field as a scientist, as I did, very well established, it's also overwhelming with how do you even approach this? And this is a topic of huge discussion at this conference I'm attending this week.
Are there a couple of sort of like core theories? Most people approach it by starting at point A or at point B, or is it really still all over the map?
Well, so in terms of symptoms, I don't know if that's what you're referring to, or in terms of research. So symptoms do develop classic symptoms. Yoel mentioned that she got the classic symptoms of menstrual pain in addition to the GI symptoms. So often there's a differential diagnosis, but it's often not recognized in the younger patients like her, because the disease can have onset of symptoms anywhere from right when you start your period until later in life, in your 20s, even in your 30s. Some women develop it after having children. Some women don't develop it until after they have maybe a C-section. So there's a whole constellation of times that it appears, symptoms that one may have. Some women have infertility as their primary symptom. It does make it very daunting for both the patient and the researcher.
All right, let's back up for just a second. One in 10 women, 10% of the worldwide population. All right, and yet still relatively unknown, not a lot of research. According to the UN, there are about 3.9 billion females in the world as of 2021. So that's 390 million females. How can it be with that many people affected by a disease, an illness, that we know so little and we research so little?
So fortunately, it is changing some, but there's a huge inertia going back decades and decades of very, very few people researching this. So we're right now building the kind of foundation in terms of relating clinical and basic science that people have had in breast cancer for decades and decades and decades. And I come to the Society for Reproductive Investigation meeting, and I go to other clinical society meetings, and just the intensity of individuals working is only ramping up now. So they've got to build that scientific infrastructure and those international collaborations that have existed in other disease areas for a very long time. So part of it is the diagnosis. Part of it is physician training. So we mentioned over and over how if this was missed, 76 doctors is just mind-blowing, but I'm actually not surprised. And part of the problem in training is you can only learn in medical school what is known. And so if there's not intensive research funding to train physician scientists, then the information doesn't percolate out to the average everyday doctor in a community health setting. So you only learn what there has been research on. So this is, you know, the fundamental root cause is not enough physician scientists are being trained. We haven't invested as a country. The world hasn't invested in these kinds of scientists over the years. And it caught up with us.
Okay, so I want to go into your research and the science you're working on. To do that, I think we have to walk through a door that is about your personal experience. So can we talk about that for a minute?
Mm-hmm.
All right. So you have experience both with endometriosis and with cancer. And mm-hmm. both of those experiences have affected how you're coming to this as a researcher. Is that right?
That's correct.
Can you talk a little bit about that journey?
Yeah. So my endometriosis journey was similar but different than the patient you just profiled. I had terrible problems as a teenager, GI, et cetera. I wasn't diagnosed until I was 28. No one ever mentioned endometriosis to me. It was an accident, and I had a very, very advanced case. And I went on to have 9 surgeries for it, many, many different drug therapies, and a lot of frustration and missed events in life and professional life, et cetera. And then the surgeon who operated on me the last 4 times, Keith Isaacson, who's local at Newton Wellesley, begged me to start doing research on endometriosis when I had, around the time I had my last surgery with him, I was in my late 40s. And it was very frightening to think about doing this for so many reasons. 1, I didn't want to face it every day. 2, it is a very messy clinical landscape. I didn't know what an engineer could bring to this research area. And, you know, the funding was not that great. And I was very well set in my other research areas in tissue engineering and regenerative medicine. But we got a foundation grant, and my husband, who's also a biological engineering professor at MIT, was really a founder in the field of systems biology. And he saw this as a marvelous opportunity to take a very messy clinical problem and bring engineering principles to try to understand it. When we started, I got diagnosed with breast cancer, and it became immediately obvious that I was classified on the basis of 3 molecular markers into being what's called triple negative. The 3 markers are related to the mechanism of the cancer, to the therapy I would get, and to the prognosis. And since then, I had cancer 12 years ago, there have been huge advances in molecular classification of cancer. What my doctor didn't do is come to me and say, Linda, your tumor is 3 centimeters, so here's what we're going to do. Not at all. But that's what we do in endometriosis. You get staged according to how big your lesions are and how many there are.
So it's a lot less differentiated than what we know and how we approach something like breast cancer?
Absolutely. There was no molecular classification. It was crazy. And yet we know some women will respond to hormone therapies and they do just fine. Other women won't respond or they have terrible side effects. Why is this? And this had really not been investigated in any kind of systematic way. So we went in and started investigating how are groups of endometriosis patients different at a molecular level, and published the first couple of papers describing potential molecular classifications. They aren't definitive, but it did get people thinking about this, and it certainly has set us off into much more sophisticated investigations in this regard, including the work that I'll speak about here today, this week at this meeting.
At the meeting. So, okay, so now for the next 20 seconds or so, I am going to way oversimplify. You are kind of a rock star as a researcher. And when I was reading more about you, you're the ear mouse lady. I mean, the ear mouse. This was groundbreaking research when you and the team you were participating in were able to grow an ear on the back of a mouse. So, I mean, we are talking about serious tissue innovation here. You talked about, you know, your work in tissue. How are you bringing those innovations into how you're tackling endometriosis now? And for a layperson like me, is this towards treatment? Is it towards diagnosis? Is it towards cure, prevention? You know, I don't know, vaccination?
So All of the above, and the basic thing is I've described how we deconstruct the patient. We take samples of her tissues and fluids and try to put her into what is a molecular basis for the disease she has, what group is she in? And then we got to reconstruct the patient. We get a hypothesis about a therapy that would work for, you know, the group of patients. And then we actually build avatars of patients in the lab using microfluidics, organs on chips, tissue engineering, so that we can test potential new therapies. Because if you diagnose a patient with endometriosis, she has symptoms, you've got to be able to do something for her, right? So just saying she's got lesions, what are you going to do for her? So we try to marry a diagnosis with how will we develop therapies for this particular kind of patient? And we have some potential therapies. We're not yet, you know, going into the clinic, but we've got collaborators. We are very, very avidly investigating certain new non-hormonal therapies for endometriosis.
So are these highly customized therapies, like at the individual patient level? I am a layperson in this realm.
So you can kind of think the individual patient level is one extreme. The other extreme would be endometriosis or not, where you would join over 100 million women around the world as having endometriosis. But in the middle, there might be, let's say, 10 groups of patients who would have molecularly similar disease. And so the groups are different from each other, but there may be 10 million people in each group. And so it's, you know, maybe kind of like when you have an infection, do you have gram negative? Do you have gram positive? So what antibiotics should we give you? Or with breast cancer, I was triple negative, so I got some supersized kind of chemo. So it's sort of like that. What group do you fall in? And so we need a diagnostic, not just to say you have endometriosis, but that you would probably benefit from a particular therapy for it. So you don't have to cycle through, as I did, drug after drug after drug for months at a time and not get any relief, just shopping for the thing that might help you.
So, excuse me, a couple of questions on gender here. First, in your lab, do you have a lot of women working on this research?
I have a lot of women and a lot of men. MIT is an amazing place. I have had so many colleagues volunteer to help me free of charge, just donate their time, who are men, because endometriosis touches almost everyone. Everybody knows someone with this disease because it is so prevalent. So we actually have quite a few men in the lab who are very, very sympathetic to the tremendous need to have all hands on deck for this. But it certainly is attractive to women. So I get probably more requests from women to come join my lab because they have personal experience, many of them.
And my understanding is that endometriosis can affect anybody who menstruates. So women, trans men, people who are non-binary, does that affect how you approach your research?
So we primarily, because of the patient populations we access and the way that we set up studies, focus on females who are XX and who have a hormone profile that's consistent with their chromosome status. There's certainly wonderful opportunities for other combinations. But when you're doing these kinds of studies, it's about the number of patients you can accrue in a clinical setting in the practice that you're working with. So everybody, you know, has a particular focus. And I think there's opportunity, but it's beyond the scope of what we have resources to
invest. So we have about 30 seconds left, Professor Griffith. What's the dream?
That we get diagnosis at the start and you get your therapy at the start and you don't even develop the disease.
Wow. And do you think that'll happen in your research and in your lifetime?
It'll happen from my students and postdocs within 20 years, maybe five. Who knows?
Wow. All right. That is Linda Griffith, a professor and director of the Center for Gynopathology Research at MIT. Professor Griffith, thanks for your work and for your time today.
Thank you.